Say August 30th, 2016, and this is the convening of the Legislative Commission on Surrogacy. I am Senator Michelle Benson stepping in for Representative Peggy Scott, who is unable to attend today. My co-chair, Senator Alice Johnson, and I will work through this process together. We thank you for your flexibility. We do have a list of testifiers, but first we need to approve the minutes from our August 16th meeting. The minutes should be in your packets. We do not have a quorum, so we can't actually take a motion. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Representative Pugh is supposed to be joining us on the phone. Representative Pugh, are you on the phone? Okay. That still leaves us one short for a quorum, so we will move to the next item on the agenda, which is the business practices of the fertility industry, focused on attorneys and brokers. The first person on my list of testifiers is June Carbone from the University of Minnesota. And I want to make sure I address you properly. Are you a doctor of law? How would you like to be addressed? Professor Carbone, please come forward. Go ahead. That is where we'd like you to testify.
And will you be keeping time, or should I keep track?
We'll keep time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you for inviting me here today. I teach at the University of Minnesota and have been fascinated as I take my students through the question of how do you practice in an area in which there is very little formal law and in which lawyers have the opportunity to structure much of what takes place. And in that context, I would be delighted to see more formal procedures for how to address surrogacy in the state, mindful of the ethical considerations. On that note, I'd like to address what are really three broad issues. The first has to do with the ethics of surrogacy and the distinction between traditional surrogacy, where the woman who gives birth is giving birth to her genetic child, versus gestational surrogacy, where the woman giving birth is giving birth to a child who is not, to whom she is not genetically related. Secondly, I'm going to talk about the way commercial actors, such as lawyers and brokers, structure the process. And in the paper that you have, I talked some about how part of what commercial actors do is to learn. And so they're repeat players in this, whereas when you see non-commercial surrogacy, you often have people who are making it up as they go along. The third thing I'm going to talk about are the really difficult ethical issues, which often have to do with shared decision-making and how we can think about structuring them. But before I begin, I'd like to note just generally that when we talk about surrogacy, we're talking about it as part of a fertility industry that changes quite rapidly. So on the horizon are new medical procedures, such as the ability to create new eggs and sperm in the lab. It may soon be possible for me at age 63 to have another child to whom I'm genetically related, though I have promised my existing children I will not do that. The industry itself is also changing rapidly. I know that much of the attention is on things like going to India for surrogacy. But what we also have is something that for plain old IVF, if you go on the websites, and I always do it before I teach my class because every time I go, they've changed. And right now, part of what they're doing, if you look at big fertility centers in New York or Los Angeles, is they are global in scope. They're bringing people from around the world to the United States for services. And for Americans who can't afford the next round of IVF, they're arranging for them to go to Mexico or for somewhere else next year. So this is a dynamic, competitive market. And to underscore that point, I would note some of the changes. between 1999 and 2013, for example, the number of gestational carriers as a percentage of all fertility cycles grew from about 1% to 2.5%. More interestingly, the number of non-U.S. residents grew. So those using gestational carriers in the United States coming from abroad grew from 10% to 18.5%. And when you see people, intended parents in particular, traveling that far, they're choosing what jurisdiction to go to based on a variety of considerations, including the quality of the services, sometimes price, but certainly on surrogacy, the background law in the jurisdiction, and their confidence about parentage. And that informs a lot of what is possible in Minnesota. So turning now to the underlying ethics, you have the article that I wrote that takes a look at the difference between traditional surrogacy and gestational surrogacy. And on the ethical front, I think they are different. When you're talking about a traditional surrogate, that is, a woman who is using her own egg, she is giving birth to a child who is, in every sense, her child. Her genetic child, her gestational child, and legally in almost all states, her legal child. Now, there may well be a father involved who is also, in every sense, a father of that child and who intends to be a legal parent. When you're talking about gestational surrogacy, on the other hand, you are talking about a woman who is giving birth to a child who is not her genetic child. So in that case, the commissioning couple will have arranged for the conception of the child either using their own gametes or donor gametes. And the gestational carrier is not involved in that decision, the decision involving conception. And so she is, in a way, a caretaker for a child that she typically views, and most people view, as the child of the commissioning parents rather than her own. What difference does it make? Well, it makes a number of differences. First, for those who are concerned about baby selling, about the idea that one should not create a child for money or even create a child for someone else. Traditional surrogacy involves that. Gestational surrogacy doesn't. The woman who gives birth is not involved in the decision to have the child. And indeed, very often, the intended parents are the biological progenitors of the child and very much want that child. It is not so different from traditional reproduction in that sense. And if you interview people, you will find that both traditional surrogates and gestational surrogates say something very similar. They say they are doing it because they want to do it. That is, they believe they're conferring a gift of life, and doing it for someone else in a way they feel very positive about. In addition, all surrogates overwhelmingly find after the fact that they did not have a problem relinquishing the child where they went into it with the idea and clear agreement and screening that that was what they were going to do from the beginning. So you don't see either of those issues as a source of exploitation that are terribly important. The reason, though, I think the difference between traditional surrogacy and gestational surrogacy matters is because of the obligation the mother feels to the child. Where it is her child, she may well feel she has an obligation that goes beyond simply honoring a contract. And one of the things when you read about cases that go wrong, especially where the parties don't know each other from the beginning, is that often the gestational carrier or the traditional surrogate find out more information about the commissioning couple or commissioning parent, things they didn't know at the beginning. If it is her child and she feels an obligation to her child, she may have reservations about the parenting ability of the commissioning parents. In a case of gestational surrogacy, that may also arise, but this, after all, is a child who is not her child, and I think the perceived obligation is different. For that reason, here's where I come out. Would I ban traditional surrogacy? No, for two reasons. First, it's safer. If you have somebody, say close friends, a sister, people have confidence in each other and they would prefer to use traditional surrogacy. We're talking about artificial insemination. It can be done with a turkey baster. We are talking about a low-tech process. It's probably safer than sexual intercourse. If you have the right people, would I say they can't do it? No, I would allow it. Secondly, I think when you look at that question, are there people you can say this is something we might want to leave open? I think there are. On the most typical cases where you're talking about a sister who feels very close to her sister who can't have a child on her own, or a brother who's in a relationship with another man, I don't see that we should be involved in regulating what they can do. Instead, I would take this approach, which is what California and a number of other states have done. They have comprehensive legislation about the parentage of in gestational surrogacy cases that recognize the intended parents as the legal parents. But they typically either have no legislation about traditional surrogacy, or they make it clear that traditional adoption laws apply. I think that's appropriate. I think in a case of traditional surrogacy, where the woman who gives birth is the biological mother of the child in every sense, there should be an adoption process. A few states allow that to take place before birth. With a home study and protections for the traditional surrogate about the commissioning couple. Other states, it simply has to be done after birth, and it is very much like any other adoption. I favor that. And if you have that background law, what you find is that very few people use traditional surrogacy. 95% of all surrogacy cases in the U.S. now are gestational surrogacy cases. But those family members and other people who have confidence in the result have that option. I'd now like to turn to gestational surrogacy and the legal issues. I could spend a lot of time on the ethics of gestational surrogacy, which has been described as womb rental rather than baby selling, even by those who are pejorative and don't believe in it. But instead, I'd like to focus on the time I have on where things go wrong and what can be done about them. I don't find the idea of gestational surrogacy intrinsically objectionable. Again, most people who do it, we don't have poor, desperate women becoming gestational surrogates. The agencies screen them out. Overwhelmingly, the people who are gestational surrogates are, have some degree of financial independence, often are staying home and taking care of other children. There are two kinds of things, though, that are concerning and that go wrong. One is this idea of commodification. And what clinics do when they're doing their job right is they separate the payment issues from the birth of the child. That is, and I can give you horror stories, I won't, don't have the commissioning parents pay the gestational carrier directly, have them pay a third party, have the payments be staggered. Don't haggle about price. Agencies ought to have fixed payments. I buy all my cars through brokers. I don't haggle. We shouldn't be haggling about this. But the most important set of issues, and I'm going to skip over a lot of the details to get to what I think are the most difficult issues, and those are decision-making about a pregnancy. And so what you have are two kinds of things that can be emotionally wrenching for everyone involved. Decisions when there are indications of birth defects in the child the gestational carrier is carrying, and selective reduction. Especially if the parents have been trying to get pregnant, they're older, egg quality or sperm quality isn't so good, the doctors may recommend implanting multiple embryos to increase the chance of success. My co-author went through this. There were only 3 embryos left still healthy. The doctors said, very unlikely all 3 will give rise to healthy infants. Implant all 3, she had triplets. Now, what happens in those cases is something I call matchmaking. Some gestational carriers don't want to carry triples. It's a greater risk to her own health, or she feels unable to do it. Some parents don't want triplets, but more importantly, may be concerned that carrying triplets increases the health risks to all three children. So some doctors will recommend selective reduction in that case, where you will terminate the pregnancy of one of the three to give the others a better chance at surviving. It's controversial. I can tell you I've talked to people involved in agencies who have had clients who want to selectively reduce twins to a singleton pregnancy. They don't feel comfortable about that. The agency doesn't like it and writes into their contracts, you can't do it. But other people and people from different countries may well have different ethical feelings about the trade-off between ensuring the health of the children who are born versus curing all of the embryos and allowing them to develop to term. What is tragic is if you have a gestational carrier with one set of views and intended parents with another set of views. I think it is completely irresponsible for an agency to use a gestational carrier, for example, who would be unwilling to carry triplets and have intended parents who want to implant three embryos and don't believe in abortion. So you can have all kinds of conflicts. How do you deal with that? My recommendation, again, on all these issues, I've laid out most of them in the article, and I can go through them in detail, but basically what commercial agencies and lawyers, when you have two independent counsels for both parties, ought to be doing is making sure that a surrogate and the commissioning couple are on the same page from the beginning of the pregnancy. I think the gestational carrier needs to have certain information, information via informed consent about the risks of pregnancy, about the possibility of multiples, about what will happen if tests indicate birth defects. They also need to be on the same page about conduct during the pregnancy. Use of alcohol, cigarette smoking. Most agencies won't bring on board a gestational carrier who smokes. Most parents don't want that. Medical opinion on coffee has been changing last year or so. Those are the kinds of things that ought to be discussed in advance. But the critical one is decision making. You will see almost all surrogacy contracts give decision making to the intended parents about things like selective reduction, abortion in the event of birth defects. They also require that the gestational carrier agree not to abort if the intended parents don't want an abortion. And they feel very strongly about that. I can't imagine any court specifically enforcing a contract that bans abortion where the gestational carrier wants it or compels it where the gestational carrier doesn't want. That would violate her bodily integrity, and I can't imagine a court ordering it. I can't imagine courts deciding that some parts of contracts about such matters are enforceable through monetary issues, for example, simply not paying the remainder of the fees owed under the contract. But I think rather than focus on the legality, the role that is critical is making sure both parties are on the same page at the beginning. So if you have two lawyers representing each side, it seems to me what a competent lawyer does is explain what is in the contract, to find out whether gestational carriers have reservations about the allocation of decision-making power to the intended parents, which is a typical contract provision, about things like birth defects or selective reduction. If you have intended parents who do not believe in abortion, I think it is also very important that the gestational carrier know that in the event of multiples or in the event of birth defects. And there are people who have very strong feelings about this irrespective of the background law of the state. This is something where both groups will feel much better about the process if they know and have shared understandings at the beginning. So let me conclude by saying what I think and I feel very strongly about when I look at what happens in jurisdictions that ban payment for brokers and third parties is you have couples who either go out of state or they do it themselves, they recruit family members, or they advertise on the internet and do it all below the radar. When that happens, you have no security about the outcome. And even brothers and sisters fight, as I can tell you. And they end up reinventing things that professionals in the field can tell you. Here's how you structure things. When you have agencies, and I'm sure you have lots of horror stories about agencies, but agencies who are in this for the long haul have an interest in having things go well. So what you would like to see is transparency about what the agency is doing and accountability if they do behave in egregious ways. How do you do that? Well, I think that goes into a lot of technical detail about things like arranging payments, about waivers of liability and when they should be enforceable, etc. But I think one thing I'd like to end on, it's very hard to anticipate what will happen in the future. So as I said, if you want to encourage surrogacy and allow it to happen in transparent ways, the most important thing that needs to be to happen is to secure parentage determinations in a very clear way. Then you end up with a set of incentives. Incentives, for example, to use gestational carriers rather than traditional carriers, that will happen pretty much automatically. In addition, if you mandate representation by counsel by both sides, professional standards of ethics should inform the lawyer role in trying to make sure both sets of clients are on the same page before things go wrong. That gives you more security than trying to mandate ethical principles through legislation. Thank you.
And note for the record, we have a quorum. We have about 4 minutes for questions for this testifier. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, you were talking about some of the terms that would be recognized by both parties, especially the
yes.
surrogate mother who would be anticipating or signing the contract, and that different elements had to be recognized. How many elements could you put in a contract?
I can tell you. Now, if you see state-mandated elements, California has some. They're very short. They fit on a page or two. Most lawyers, the ones I've had come and talk to my class, their surrogacy contracts are now up to 48 pages. Lawyers anticipate what can go wrong and write in for every contingency. But there are only a handful that I think are really important. I think that things that deal with the ones I would highlight are how payment is to occur, the source of the gametes, that is, whether or not the intended parents are the biological parents, conduct during the pregnancy, and decision-making about the child, including, you know, things like bed rest. I've mentioned abortion in the event of birth defects and selective reduction. But there are often a series of other issues. It's now possible to operate in utero on a child to correct birth defects before the child is born. There are cases where it's really important that the mother, that the gestational carrier, not travel too much. In other cases, Zika would be an issue right now. There are a variety of issues like that where some of these things are common sense, but some of these things are things that medical professionals disagree about. Traveling to Florida at the moment is one of them. And so you would want to have discussions of those things. My experience is that lawyers almost never take things out of their contracts. They only add.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lamont.
Madam Chair, Doctor, you should see what we do in the legislature when we add things to bills.
Yes.
Amendments can go on forever. The concern I would have is whether or not the surrogate mother would have a confidence in understanding those terms. In your experience, is that something that is a given and that there isn't a dispute later on?
It depends on the professionals involved. One of the things that I've been looking into with my co-author is there is a new style in informed consent in IVF generally with respect to health risks. I have supplied the commission with a link to videos that explain how IVF is done and what the risks are. But the group that's developing it is also developing a product that involves question and answer afterwards. You know, you have to take a test. Mm-hmm. And this is for their patients, so that the understanding is more real. The attorneys I've spoken to, who I view as the standard for ethical behavior, make a point of highlighting and talking about the kinds of issues, such as abortion, they think might be controversial.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair,
Senator Kramer.
As I look at this, my experience with contracts is a contract that I get involved in. I'm a real estate agent, and so
yes.
We put together contracts between two parties. Usually there are 25 to 30 pages now, and we still run into dispute even when contractual elements are specifically outlined and requested that there be initial by each paragraph so that both parties know exactly and they attest that they understand those elements. And we still run into huge discussion and conflict at closing tables or further down as we wait for the closing to take place. And I can only imagine, and it's my maybe single understanding of human nature, there will be conflict.
Yeah,
and
I don't disagree with you.
Was I under the impression that you stated in your early comments that sometimes looking for a surrogate mother sometimes requires an individual from outside of the state?
No, I'm saying not that it requires. Rather that in jurisdictions like New York or Michigan that banned commercial surrogacy, what you see is that people from those states go elsewhere. In New York, they go to Connecticut because Connecticut has very favorable surrogacy laws. If you use a surrogate in Connecticut, then Connecticut a law will apply to the parentage issues. And so why not go to Connecticut? What some parents do in the state of Washington, for example, is they enter into their own agreements by finding somebody over the Internet. Frankly, I think that's much worse than using a commercial broker. I would emphasize you can't prevent conflict, but you can predict some conflicts that will occur. And unlike most real estate, I make a point after I buy a house, I rarely go back to the buyer, and I hope these my buyers don't come back to me. But surrogacy is not like that. The quality of the experience often does depend on the relationship between a gestational carrier and the intended parents, and they're going to have contact. And so making sure that they don't hate each other before they ever meet is pretty high on my list of ethical behavior.
Okay. Members, thank you. We have reached the end of our time for Professor Carbone. I want to thank you for informing us, and we'll move to our next testifier. I believe Dr. Teresa Collette from the University of St. Thomas.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
While she's getting ready, if we want to approve the minutes.
Yes. We do have a quorum, members. Your minutes are in your packet. Could I have someone move approval of those minutes?
So moved.
Senator Dibble will move. Thank you, Representative Wills. And all those in favor of approving the minutes as presented, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay. And Representative Pugh, I presume you're an aye.
Aye.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Collette, if you could state your name for the record, and welcome.
Certainly. My name is Teresa Collette. I'm a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas, where I teach courses in property, constitutional litigation, as well as a course this semester on comparative regulation of human sexuality and human rights. And, of course, the surrogacy issue in the international context is one that is deeply debated and contested. But my testimony today is going to focus primarily on the domestic issues that are presented. I want to state for the record that any testimony I give today represents my personal and professional views only and does not represent the views of the University of St. Thomas or any other individual or entity that I might be associated with. Surrogacy as an issue has been, as this commission is well aware, before the Minnesota legislature since the Baby M case. We've seen legislative proposals that go everywhere from prohibiting it completely to basically blessing what are commercial contracts drafted by the industry. And somewhat everything in between. In attending last week's, or the last hearing of this commission, I was intrigued to notice that based on the record that was present at that time and having checked the website again today, this commission has not had the opportunity to actually look at a surrogacy contract itself. And so you will find attached to my written testimony a form that is used for continuing legal education and offered as a template quite often. In order to allow you to evaluate what a surrogacy contract might look like. It is shorter than the typical 40 to 60 page contract that Professor Carbone mentioned, but it does address many of the essential issues that she identified. Let me also note at the outset that surrogate births in Minnesota are exceedingly rare. The commission has had the benefit of a report from the Department of Vital Records, and you see that I produced a table on page 2 of my written testimony showing that to date, from the time period between 2011 to 2016, July 19th, there have been 75 total live births in Minnesota where the Department of Vital Records was aware that they were the product of surrogacy by virtue of a pre-birth order. The Department of Vital Records estimated that there are approximately 100 additional replacement certificates issued each year after a post-birth surrogacy order. So if we combine this and look at the total numbers of births in that five-year period, even accepting that that estimate of 100 additional post-birth surrogacy replacement certificates is accurate for the entire time period, we see that surrogate births in the state of Minnesota comprise less than 0.2% of 1% of all births. 75 births that we know of with certainty, and an estimated another 550 that the Department of Vital Records have given us. Where the average birth rate in the state of Minnesota exceeds 68,000 every year. So we're not talking about a common practice in the state of Minnesota at this point in time, nor do I believe that we're talking about a common practice throughout the United States, although it's very difficult to get accurate records on this. Very few states require the reporting of the existence of a surrogacy, and some states treat it as a confidential proceeding. In addition, I want to note at the outset that the pain of infertility, the burden of infertility, is something that is experienced by approximately 6% of all women ages 15 to 45, according to the CDC, and somewhere between 1 to 2% of men in the United States under the age of 45 who are sexually active. So it is not an uncommon experience, but surrogacy is not the common response to it, interventions in other ways. And those interventions include some new, interesting, important, and hopefully progressing ways of addressing things like women who have had their uterus removed because of cervical cancer or uterine cancer. According to news reports, in 2014, there were 9 Swedish women who successfully underwent transplants for uteruses in order to allow them to bear their own children. They are temporary uteruses, which sounds very bizarre, but the reason is in order for those transplants to in order for the women to successfully continue the transplant, they are on immunosuppressing drugs, and so you don't want to do that for the rest of your lifetime unless it's absolutely necessary. So typically, the intention of the researchers in this area is that a woman will have a uterus transplant. She will deliver one or two or three, whatever her ideal family size is, and then the uterus will be removed in that case. There's also the development of an artificial placenta that the University of Michigan has issued a report on, where five premature infants were able to be sustained on it. It's very encouraging when we look at that way of dealing with people who can't carry their pregnancies to term. And then finally, perhaps a little more futuristically and science fiction-y, is the complete artificial womb, which is a subject of significant debate and concern about whether or not that environment would sustain a child in a healthy way. So when we think about infertility, I want to stress that there are new and developing scientific methods and devices that may moot out the question of surrogacy entirely. Women may be able to bear their own children, and that eliminates any concern we have about the commodification of women's bodies and the commodification of children in that instance. So I think it is good that Minnesota is one of the 32 states in the union that simply have not addressed this statutorily, because it is a developing area of science quite clearly. Four states have completely banned surrogacy. New York has legislation before them that would change that right now. Those are listed for you in my written testimony. 14 additional states have statutory provisions, and they go all the way from limiting surrogacy to what is called altruistic surrogacy, surrogacy where there is no compensation and only direct reimbursement occurs, to states that allow both gestational, traditional surrogacy, and allow payment for that. There is one report that the average compensation beyond reimbursement of expenses in California runs somewhere between $25,000 and $50,000 for each successful pregnancy. Last hearing, this commission had a rather confusing presentation toward the end about how parentage is decided, and I wanted to clarify that for the commission. The citations are in my written testimony. A woman who gives birth in the state of Minnesota at this point in time is the legal mother. That is undisputed. There is no statute to the contrary. It doesn't matter whether there was donor sperm used or not. That is the legal directive under the statutes. Paternity is a more complex definition. A mother will always be present at the birth. The father may or may not be, for good or for ill cause. Certainly, there are many women who are the wives of military men who are stationed overseas who give birth alone and bravely. So paternity, as far as the commission's concerned, we need to look at the presumption related to the husband. Usually the surrogacy contracts will address and bind the husband of the surrogate, so he too will not be presumed to be the father of the child if the child is to be given to intended parents. Your Senate counsel, Ms. Pontius, gave a very helpful overview of the law in Minnesota at this point in time. I have included a couple of more references to it for there. But I want to spend my final time in sort of thinking about what is the right language to talk about this issue, because language matters. You, as people involved in politics, know that better than I do, although lawyers are supposed to be specially trained in that. The fact that we're discussing this in terms of parentage and child biases the conversation in some ways. It looks like it is simply a new form of family formation. But when we look at the contract that I've attached, it seems to me that it's equally fair to characterize this as an employment contract or the purchase of services and perhaps even the purchase of the child. Interestingly, in looking for a Minnesota statute that forbids the sale of children, I discovered after consultation with our criminal law experts and my own research that the only sale of children in Minnesota that's illegal is where the sale is for the purpose of forced labor or for sexual exploitation. So the sale of an infant where there is no expectation that they will be a slave or engaged in forced labor nor sexual exploitation simply is uncovered both by federal statute and by state statute, which I was kind of surprised to see the gap of the law in that way. Therefore, any concern we might have about a surrogacy arrangement violating that state or federal statute doesn't appear to be well-founded, at least based on the research that I've done and the research of one of my colleagues who specializes in the area of criminal law. The contract, by its nature, if you look at the restatement of employment law, looks to me very much like an employee-employer contract. The distinction between an independent contractor and an employee is based on the direction that the employer has in the way that the services are conducted. And if we turn to the sample contract in these last few minutes, we see that on the first page, it tells us that by matter of this contract, the surrogate and husband are over 21. It also includes a provision that it be used only in cases where the intended mother is incapable of becoming pregnant or where a pregnancy would endanger her health. If you turn to the next page, there are recitals of the fact that there is no coercion and that this is fully informed and that the surrogate and her husband have, free of emotional duress, consented to this after careful and unemotional reflection. I actually find that rather unrealistic. I can't imagine thinking about becoming pregnant, whether for myself or for others, in an unemotional way, but perhaps Dr. Spock lives on. Paragraph K, however, really is a prejudicial paragraph, it seems to me, a paragraph that is intended to appeal to the emotions of the trier of fact if this is ever contested, and shows to me the bias of discussing this in matters in terms of parent and child. The surrogate and her husband understand that the intended parents have waited many years and are now expanding significant time and financial resources to bring a child into their home and now relying greatly on the surrogate to carry their child. It's understood that the parents have grave, severe, and intense emotional distress. It's a very appealing paragraph if you're the intended parents, but as a lawyer for a surrogate, if I were representing her, I would strike that paragraph. It seems to me it's very prejudicial in any future litigation. It also says that any remedy that the court might give, the parties agree to in advance, being limited to the narrowest possible remedy. You go to the next page, and there's a discussion of custodial or parental rights. And it is reassuring that this particular form reassures the surrogate that the intended parents will take custody of the child regardless of any handicaps that the child might be born with. And that is something that has been litigated and continues to be litigated both in the United States and in foreign countries. Interestingly, there's a case in India where the intended parents did not want the child that the surrogate was caring for the child's own sake, but they wanted a savior sibling, or what's known in bioethical literature, a savior sibling. Their existing biological child had a medical condition that required an organ transplant, and so the new child was to provide those services to the family. If you look at medical and psychological evaluations, another aspect of this particular contract that I would find deficient is that while I understand why the intended parent should have access to the medical records of the surrogate and her husband in evaluating whether to employ this couple, it does not impose upon them any subsequent duty of confidentiality about the medical records that are revealed to them in the context of litigation or elsewhere. And it opens up virtually all medical records of the surrogate to that couple. The surrogate's conduct, as you've already heard about from the prior witness, is regulated by Section 8 of the contract and extends to whether or not she smokes cigarettes, marijuana, other substances, drinks alcoholic beverages, undergoes any medical or acupuncture that would break the skin. And it also includes an agreement regarding dental care so that the intended parents determine whether such medical procedures are appropriate or necessary during the pendency of the pregnancy. In subparagraph 8, it shows that the intended parents have control of who the surrogate sees as her treating physician, as well as the hospital that she gives birth to if it's a high-risk pregnancy. But paragraph 9, or section 9, is the paragraph that is currently the subject of intense litigation in California, where there is an allocation of the right regarding termination of pregnancy, either because of selective termination. There's been an implantation of 3 or 4 embryos, and all have implanted. And it indicates where the woman's health, physical health, or her life is at stake, the surrogate controls the decision. But otherwise, it is the decision of the parents, the intended parents, and the contracting party in that case is binding the surrogate to act in accordance with that, so long as it's done before 22 weeks of gestation. In other words, if there's some indication that there's some fetal abnormality, it is the intended parent, not the surrogate, who makes that decision, and the surrogate agrees in advance to comply with that decision. Now, I agree with Professor Carbone's testimony that specific performance of that particular provision is highly unlikely in any court, notwithstanding the precedent of judicial opinions that deny women who are no longer capable of conceiving a child access to their embryos over the objection of their ex-spouse. I don't think a court would order a woman to undergo an abortion. But there are numerous cases where the threat and the reality of subsequent litigation for damages when the woman refuses to adhere to that directive have been brought. And in fact, the representations in this include, in paragraph B, that there are serious legal repercussions, including but not limited to all remedies available to the intended parents in law and in equity, including the surrogate's liability for any added costs associated with the care of the child, and also including but not limited to the cost of medical and other care of the child with special needs. Combine that with the opening recitation of the emotional distress that would be caused by the lack of successful pregnancy, and you have a ready-made plaintiff's lawsuit in that case. Let me finally note for or direct your attention to the final paragraph of Section 10 that provides for independent counsel, but the surrogate and her husband's counsel will be paid by the intended parents. That is always a tricky situation for lawyers. Minnesota law, like every other state, allows payment by third parties. It's something that I experienced in practice with prenuptial contracts, where Cinderella is marrying Prince Charming, and Prince Charming pays for Cinderella's legal fees. And so there is some concern that that payment will influence the judgment of the surrogate's counsel. There's a provision for life insurance recognizing the possible death of the surrogate and future contact. With that, let me stop, but commend closer examination of the contract as a whole so that you can see some of the complexities in this area and answer any questions that the commission might have.
Thank you, Dr. Collette. We have approximately 5 minutes. Our previous testifier was given a little more latitude, and so we have about 5 minutes for questions. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Collette, do you have in your study, have you determined whether or not when there's an attorney present, do they represent a single party in this transaction, or do they sometimes represent both at the signing of a contract? Do you know?
It's my understanding, based on the testimony before this commission, that there are some attorneys who believe that they can engage in dual representation, representing both the surrogate and the commissioning party. And in looking at the Minnesota Treatise on Professional Responsibility, there is a... it is unclear exactly how a Minnesota court would come out on whether that is ethically permissible or whether it's malpractice. In my practice prior to becoming a professor, we had the common situation of adult children taking over a parent's business, and both parties would ask us, or a husband and wife who had prior marriage or children from prior marriages who wanted representation. It was my practice to only represent one when there were children from a prior representation, notwithstanding some clients referred to it as the full employment provision of attorneys, but I thought the protection against conflicts were way too important to allow.
Madam Chair, just as a quick follow-up, in the event that there was a conflict and there was an actual suit and a plaintiff filed, what would be the role of that one attorney who started the contract representing both parties?
Once the disagreement, well, first the attorney would be a material witness and therefore could not go forward in representing either party. There is an interesting case out of New Jersey where, unrelated to surrogacy, but a husband and wife had gone to a firm for estate planning, joint estate planning. The husband was engaged in an affair and had impregnated his lover. Because of a typographical error in entering the client's name into the conflicts check of the law firm, the firm ended up representing both the pregnant lover who was suing the husband for paternity and the husband and wife in estate planning. When that was discovered, that led to marital discord, as one might anticipate. The firm eventually withdrew from all representation, but they were found legally liable to the wife because they refused to disclose to her the confidences they received from the lover, thinking that their duty of confidentiality trumped their duty of full disclosure to their client. So it's a very complex situation.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Collette. Our next testifier is Joe Langfeld. Mr. Langfeld. Thank you, Mr. Langfeld. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I'm Joe Langfeld. I represent Human Life Alliance. We're a nonprofit educational organization based here in Minnesota. Our roots go back to the 1960s. We're incorporated in 1977 as an official organization in Minnesota. In 1990, we began our official work, which is an educational work which deals with bioethics and education from everything from beginning of life to end of life and how we treat people as they're preparing for their final days here. I come to you bringing you testimony from our organization itself, which I'll read you at the end, and a couple of prepared comments here. As commercial gestational surrogacy becomes more common around the globe for individuals and couples either able or unwilling to carry children to term, Human Life Alliance repeats its opposition to legislation which enables this dangerous practice for women. Recently, we've heard advocates share stories about altruistic beliefs of surrogacy. But HL believes our medical and social systems are not prepared to help women through the physical, emotional, and financial consequences of commercial gestational surrogacy. Little information is published about the negative effects on women who act as surrogates. These women, commercial gestational surrogates, are at risk of coercion from parents and others who seek to pressure them into abortion when things go wrong, when multiple embryos are implanted to increase chances for success, or when a fetus is diagnosed with a condition that the parents are unwilling to support, selective reduction is recommended. This is simply a euphemism for killing the extra or unwanted children already developing in a womb. International surrogacy has its own special issues. When couples, and these are typically Western couples, rent out a surrogate's uterus, pay for the IVF procedure, and then reimburse a woman for the actual time of gestation, we see fees as high as $125,000 per child today. This not only risks the chance of viewing children as a modern-day commodity, but I ask you, what percentage of the dollars actually get paid to the surrogate herself? The pressure on many women to accept this income is immense. These fees are often more money than women in developing nations could hope to earn in a lifetime. Some commercial gestational surrogates report feeling pressured into surrogacy again by family members just to make extra money. Many of these women are unable to read the contracts they're required to sign. They are kept in locations under lock and key and forced to deliver by cesarean section, which represents a much higher risk for the birth mother. There is no guarantee the women will receive the full payment promised when the child is delivered, and in the event of implantation of multiple embryos, if that is achieved, and the purchasing couple only wants one child, other babies may be sold on the black market to anyone willing to pay the price. Both the mother and the original contracting parents have no idea this happens to one or more of their biological children. With the potential moral dangers and obvious financial pitfalls, HLA asks you to weigh the societal risk of encouraging commercial gestational surrogacy. Why does it seem like there's an outpouring of support for commercial gestational surrogacy today? As a fertility awareness instructor of 13 years, I'm a husband and a father who struggled with fertility issues. It's easy to understand the heartfelt need of couples seeking to start a family. But I suggest to you a financial component drives the new public policy push for commercial gestational surrogacy. with costs peaking at $125,000 per birth and surrogates receiving on average $20,000 to $35,000, in some cases $10,000 to $25,000 per birth. I ask you to think about this equation and recall the phrase often used for any industry later investigated for abuse. Follow the money. For these reasons and more, Human Life Alliance continues to stand by our original resolution on surrogacy as adopted in 1987, and that resolution follows here. Whereas the practice of surrogate motherhood dehumanizes and depersonalizes both woman and child, reducing the essence of humanity into raw material which can be manipulated, commercialized, and expended, and whereas the practice of surrogate motherhood undermines the sanctity of life, recommending abortion in most contracts if the unborn child is expected to have handicaps, and whereas the practice of surrogate motherhood exploits women, treating biological mothers as mere receptacles, denying her natural inclination towards bonding family life, and whereas the practice of surrogate parenting strikes at the inherent integrity of marriage, motherhood, and fatherhood, and necessary foundations for healthy families and a healthy society, be it resolved that Human Life Alliance oppose any legislation which would recognize or legalize the practice of surrogate parenting. And further, be it resolved that Human Life Alliance call upon members of the Minnesota Legislature to ban the practice of surrogate parenting. Passed by the Coordinating Committee of Human Life Alliance, September 14, 1987. I'll leave my written comments here for staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Langfeld. Do we have questions for this testifier? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Langfeld, just for my own clarification, when you talked about women being locked up and so forth, you're not talking about surrogacy in this country, are you?
No, that's under internationally, particularly in India in this case. But you'll want to be aware that India has passed new legislation in the last week. I can't give you an update on that since I was out of town on other matters.
Thank you.
And Representative Pugh, did I hear you on the phone? Okay.
Did you?
Questions at the end.
Okay, at the end of all the testimony or at the end of Mr. Langfeld's testimony?
At the end of all of the testimony. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Langfeld? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next testifier, we actually have a phone call scheduled at 2:10. Is that correct?
She's on the line.
She's on the line right now. If we could move to Kim Bergman, if she's available.
Yes, I'm on the line.
Excellent. Thank you. Proceed.
Hi. My name is Dr. Kim Bergman. I'm a licensed psychologist in California. And I'm also the co-owner of Burning Generations, a surrogacy agency that's been in existence for 20 years, helping people have babies. And I want to share a couple words from the agency perspective. We're often vilified, however, we're really just putting together a team. So surrogacy, when it's done ethically, and the way it's done with most agencies in the United States, it's a collaboration between a group of fully informed, consenting adults who all come together for the common purpose of helping somebody become a parent. And we spend a great deal of time screening both the parents, the surrogates, and the donors to make sure that they fully understand the short-term, long-term, and forever ramifications of what they're doing. We understand and respect adult women as being able to choose for themselves, consenting for themselves once educated and supported to undergo this process. The screening process for a surrogate can take anywhere from 2 months or more, and typically, at our agency and at most big agencies that practice ethically, about 2% of the women who apply to be surrogates actually go on to be surrogates. And in the case of my company, in 20 years, we have never had a surrogate change her mind, refuse,
or have any problem relinquishing the child to its own parents, refuse to have a medical procedure or insist that having one that there wasn't under contract, or be forced to do anything that she didn't want to do. We have not had that conflict in our 20-year history. I want to address a topic that I think is what makes many people uncomfortable about commercial surrogacy, and that's the idea of anybody being compensated and the need to justify or to understand what people are being compensated for. So a typical surrogacy arrangement will cost anywhere between $100,000 and $200,000, depending on how long it takes the person to get pregnant, and there's some variance in different ages. And of those costs, all but a small amount are hard costs, so they pay for the doctor, the lawyer, the psychologist, the insurance, the travel, the medication, the egg donor fees, if there's an egg donor, the surrogate fees, and the agency fees. And I want to address that point from the perspective of an agency owner, because I think that's in particular what you're wanting me to talk about, and I'd like to share about that. So most commercial agencies charge between about $18,000 and $25,000 for their services. And as you've heard in the previous speakers, there are many moving parts in a surrogacy journey. And what the agency is paid for is coordinating, screening, finding, managing all of those moving parts. And it is why we don't have women being exploited or feeling like they're being forced to do something or refusing to do something, because we are managing and coordinating, case coordinating the entire journey. So that fee is typically paid at increments during the process. In my agency, we're paid part of it as a deposit, then the other part when the clients are matched with the surrogate. And that is paid only one time, meaning that over the typical length of a surrogacy journey is about 2 years. It can be 3 years. And that fee is not, doesn't repeat. It's paid just at the beginning, and it covers the entire length of the surrogacy journey services, start to finish. So that, just to be clear, includes coordinating all of the professionals, the doctor, lawyer, psychologist, the insurance, screening and managing the egg donor and surrogate, and matching all parties, and then supporting all parties throughout the entire process, all the way through about 6 to 8 weeks postpartum. In addition, most ethical agencies have multiple kinds of insurance that protect the client's money. The money is in a trust. It's not commingled with the agency's operating expenses. It's their money, and that money is used to pay all of the hard costs throughout the entire process. So it's important, I think, you know, as I travel the world, and I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've been a licensed psychologist for 30 years, I understand that there's an ick factor when your money is exchanging hands, but it is a fee-for-service, and all of the hard costs in the process need to be paid for. I've helped thousands of people in the 20 years that I've been doing this have babies. About half of our clients are gay families. About half of our clients are heterosexual families who are dealing with infertility or some kind of medical fragility and are unable to carry their own babies. And I have very proudly helped those thousands of families bring their children into the world. Third-party assisted reproduction, which is what this is simply a process by which people need some help from third parties. And it is maybe a little new-agey, maybe a little cutting-edgy, but it is an evolution of medical technology, legal technology, social milieu, and the willingness of some women to share in the greatest gift possible. And I'll just end with, and then certainly available for questions, who surrogates are. So surrogates are very well screened. They have to be, have given birth themselves, raising their children. They've had easy, uncomplicated pregnancies and deliveries. And most of the time, they come to surrogacy because they knew someone who was dealing with infertility, maybe a family member or a friend. And they may have even offered that person, who then went on to have their own baby or declined their help, and they are still wanting to fulfill that for somebody. Surrogate's greatest joy for themselves is being moms. They love being parents, and they see this as the greatest possible gift that they can give another person, to share the joy that they know as parents, to another set of people who without their help could not realize that same joy. And they're motivated by a very healthy mix of altruism and normal, healthy, required for good, healthy living, narcissism. So they're strong, they're confident, they are optimistic, they are going into this eyes wide open with the intention of helping another family know the same joy that they know as a parent. And as an agency and as a psychologist, my job and my pleasure to do this job every day is to help coordinate that process so that the outcomes can be joyous and stress-free and monumental for all the parties involved. And surrogates want to...
Dr. Bergman? All right, it appears we have lost the call.
I can hear you.
Okay, you're back. Thank you. Please continue.
I'm not sure when you lost me. I could hear you guys, so...
You were kind of finalizing, but I'm not saying that to shorten your...
That's okay, I was finalizing, yes.
If that helps you.
And we appear to have lost you again. I'm just going to keep talking to you until you... you are not on the call anymore. Please make note of your questions, members. We are going to... Are you...
Hello?
Yep. All right, we can hear you again.
Yeah, it's very strange. I'm on a landline and I'm not moving, so I don't know what's going on. I can hear you guys when you're saying that you cannot hear me anymore, so it's kind of strange. But anyway, I am here, so...
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left with you on our schedule. I'd like to open it up to questions from members. And Representative Wills?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's kind of a two-part question for Dr. Bergman. First of all, you mentioned that surrogates would have to have carried a child on their own before to show that they're able to carry a child. Can you expound on what criteria your agency requires for a surrogate, and then also criteria for the intended parents that they would have to meet?
Yes.
Proceed, Dr. Bergman.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, thank you. And now we can't hear you again.
I'm on a landline. Not moving.
We hear you now.
We can hear you.
You can hear me? Okay, I'm so sorry. I'm sitting still on a landline, so I don't understand what's happening. Surrogates have to, they have to have given birth. They have to be raising their child. They undergo a criminal background check. They have to have a minimum family income level, and that's all. Everything that I'm stating is verified by paperwork. We look at their medical records. We look at their taxes and their pay stubs. They obviously have to live in a state where surrogacy is safe and legal, and where they will be protected, and where the surrogacy contract will be upheld. They have to have an absence of criminal background, mental health history, drug or alcohol abuse history. They have to be in a stable environment, stable relationship, stable job. All of these things are verified. And they have to be, they are fully medically as well as psychologically screened, as well as they have to be approved for medical insurance that will cover the surrogacy pregnancy.
And Representative Wills, you had another question, I believe.
Th- Thank you, Madam Chair. So that was for the surrogates. What about for the intended parents? And then I'll have a follow-up. Thank you,
yes,
Doctor.
Sorry. The intended parents also undergo a criminal background check. They also have a psychoeducational consultation and assessment and numerous conversations and as well as the background check. We don't look at their finances because we do collect the funds up front, so they, that's a different issue for them. But they undergo, full medical screening, blood work, all the FDA labs, HIV, STDs, all of that, drug and alcohol, all of the things.
Thank you. And Representative Wills has a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding is, because you're based out of California, that in California, surrogacy is legal. And I'm curious how much of these criteria are dictated by state law and how much do you determine on your own, either, exceeding maybe what the state law is?
Yes, we don't actually determine anything on our own. We work with a wonderful group of attorneys, some of which I think are in the room with you there, as well as throughout the entire country. So we comply completely with whatever the laws are in the state where the surrogate lives. And that's why we don't have surrogates from every state in the country. So the surrogates have to come from a state that has an equally safe and clear surrogacy law. Because obviously that's where the baby's going to be born, and we want to uphold the law in whatever state that is.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Johnson had a question.
Follow-up on Representative Wills' question. It surprises me that your criteria for intended parents is quite different than surrogates. And I'm wondering, do you look into their job security, whether they've had any criminal activity in their lives or various things like that in terms of what happens with the child when this has been carried by a woman who cares deeply about the child?
Yes, I do believe that I did say that the intended parents have a full criminal background check and psychological assessment consultation and the full medical review. There's what, the STDs and drug, alcohol, and nicotine. So they do have very similar screening for the
surrogate. I'd like to talk to you about parental kind of things, like maybe going to church, having an interest in community and so forth.
We don't pass judgment on that for anyone in our society who is going to have sex tonight and get pregnant. Nor do we pass that particular judgment on any parents who need help having a baby with by the help of another person. That's a very personal decision, and we don't weigh in on that.
In my view, they're both are very personal decisions, both the surrogate and the intended parents. But thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yes.
And Mr. Pollack, you have a question for Dr. Bergman.
Dr. Bergman, is the oversight and regulation of the surrogacy agencies in California done by a state agency, and how does it compare or contrast to adoption agency oversight?
No, there is no state oversight other than to the extent that we comply with all the business laws in California. We comply with all of the FDA regulations as they pertain to the medical aspect of the process, but there is no legal oversight of surrogacy agencies. We belong to every organization possible for self-regulation, and we maintain ethics boards. For myself, I'm a psychologist, so I am bound by the Board of Psychology in California. But there are no specific regulations that regulate surrogacy as a business.
Any further questions from the members? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Bergman,
for joining us by telephone. We'll move on to our next testifier, Mr. Steve Schneider.
Madam Chairs.
Mr. Schneider, please proceed.
Thank you very much. As I think I've disclosed in the past, I am an attorney that's been practicing in the area of surrogacy for more than 30 years. I am also the active owner and director of a separate entity, which is an agency that, like Dr. Bergman's, screens, recruits, and matches surrogates with intended parents. So I have a foot in each area in terms of the business practices of both law firms and lawyers and agencies. The first thing I'd like to do is affirm Dr. Bergman's testimony as being accurate as to the general practices of those agencies across the country that do surrogacy and do it well. As the agency, it's important to understand that if it is to be done well, reliably, and successfully, surrogacy is a process of 100 different steps that cannot be done in a different order, of which none can be omitted. They involve psychologists at the beginning, they involve doctors, they involve lawyers, they involve financial escrow companies, they involve insurance issues. All of those different areas come together in a surrogacy, and the only entity that understands and sews the fabric of those disparate organizations and professionals is the agency. They know the sequence. So for reliable surrogacy, agencies are not optional. They're crucial. It's very similar to the intermediary in an adoption setting that must safely act as the buffer between the birth mother and the adoptive parents. Just as an agency is necessary there to implement best practices to protect both sides of the party and the children, an agency and surrogate fulfills the same role, but in a totally different setting. It's not an adoption. It's not a situation where intended parents are receiving someone else's child. It's a setting where the intended parents have entrusted their child to someone else temporarily and are receiving the child back. A number of times I've heard the word commodification in testimony today, and I just want to address that for 15 seconds. Commodification means there's a commodity, something that is being sold. And the implication is that in surrogacy, a surrogate is selling her baby. That's not the case. The intended parents create the embryo. They want to have a child. They go into a fertility clinic. They put their egg and sperm together, or one of their gametes and donor sperm, and they create an embryo. Under Minnesota law, that embryo is under their sole control. It belongs to them. It is their child. For those people who believe in personhood at fertilization, that embryo is the intended parent's child. And it's an existent child if you want to go down that path. When they ask someone else, and someone else willingly volunteers to carry that child for them, that person is receiving the intended parent's child for a temporary period under the express terms of an agreement that everybody has willingly entered into. And at the end of the gestation is returning the parent's child to them, to whom it rightfully belongs. There's no sale. There's a payment for the services of the person who provided care, just like a daycare provider provides services during the day for working professionals that cannot provide the parental role during the workday. That doesn't give the daycare provider a right to keep the child. It doesn't give the surrogate the right to keep the child. It's not commodification. It's not baby selling. So agencies, as Dr. Bergman testified, follow the screening protocols with all of the protections to make sure that only those women who are knowingly and voluntarily participating in the process and who are suitable to it can participate. Dr. Bergman talked about the services that agencies provide, and as I said, those services are similar to an adoption agency. I provided as one of the handouts in your packet an example of the type of services that agencies provide. Starting with the coordination and screening of surrogates, it goes through the screening of intended parents, as Dr. Bergman talked about, the facilitation or referral in fulfilling the client's basic medical and legal requirements, communication, matching of the surrogate, provision about information about fertility clinics. The agency also provides legal support in either referring the intended parents out to an attorney who can draft the contract and the surrogate to a separate attorney, or providing other legal services within the scope of the legal relationship that the intended parents establish with that attorney. It also helps evaluate the available insurance for the surrogate to make sure there's maternity and delivery care, postnatal complications coverage, and postnatal care for the child. It also helps facilitate the interaction between the surrogate, the donor, if any, the intended parents, and the fertility clinic. It also makes sure that the money for the parents is escrowed. As Dr. Bergman said, that money is taken in. It's given to a third-party escrow company over which the agency has no control, and then it is kept in a safe place until it's required to be paid out according to the terms of the contract. It talks about the mediation and facilitation of exchange of medical information and relationship of the parties during the pregnancy, and it does the same thing after birth until all the medical bills are paid and the insurance issues are resolved. As Dr. Bergman said, that relationship for an agency can extend from 2 to 3 to 4 years. Through my agency, if a client gets all the way into the middle of a pregnancy and a pregnancy unfortunately ends by stillbirth or some other defect, and the parents have to go all the way back to the beginning of the process, there's no additional agency fee. If they have to do that 4 times, the agency will do it for the same fee that they charged at the beginning without any additional cost, because people should not be prevented from being parents because they can't afford the process. So agencies that are ethical are sensitive to that issue, and I think they all have the capacity to do it well. As Dr. Bergman said in response to a question, there is no specific regulation of agencies in California or anywhere else. In my 7-year tenure as the chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee, I initiated and ultimately had passed through the House of the American Bar Association the American Bar Association Model Act governing assisted reproductive technology agencies. It's also in your packet. As the chair of that committee, as someone that practices in the industry as both an attorney and an agency, I think regulation is appropriate if it's deemed necessary by those people in power. And this is ratified by 400,000 members of the ABA through a unanimous House of Delegates vote that said, if you want to regulate surrogacy agencies, here's a model. Nobody's opposed to that kind of regulation. It's appropriate. That kind of regulation would create an agency exactly the way mine is run. The bottom line is, at this point in time, given the void in Minnesota law for regulating surrogacy in a safe environment, an agency like mine is the only structure for intended parents to have that safe procedure imposed from an outside source. So agencies are not a villain in this process. Do they need to pay their employees? Yes, I have 20 employees. Do they have to pay the rent? Yes. Do they have to charge for their services? Of course they do. Are they motivated by money? No. Do they go out and seek intended parents and lure them in so they pay them? No. They are there when intended parents need them. Intended parents find them and are referred to them. And it's an appropriate dynamic to make this process safe and it will still be a necessary mechanism once legislation is passed, because there will still be the coordination of those five different professions and various other aspects of the surrogacy process. In terms of the insurance that Dr. Bergman referenced, I have provided template copies of two kinds of insurance that my agency has. It's professional liability insurance, in case I don't know everything I think I know and I make a mistake. My clients are paid by the insurance company for my negligence. It's also a criminal bond. So if one of my employees, unknown to me, to take the money of the clients, my criminal bonding company, through my bonding and very strenuous vetting, pays them back. So they are protected economically and they are protected ethically. As for my law firm, I provide legal services to people that don't use an agency. Often they have siblings or friends or someone that they knew of that acts as their surrogate. When I act as my attorney, I have my malpractice liability insurance. So I also have my professional rules of responsibility as an ethical code to guide my conduct. Both the legal services and the agency services can be run in a way that promotes and stabilizes a safe process among willing participants. And at that point, I will stop talking and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Schneider, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schneider, I had a question. Professor Collette gave examples in her testimony about a contract and highlighted a lot of provisions that she believes that there are issues with. Is this the contract that she cited, and you were here for the testimony, I understand, is that a standard contract, or can you talk a little bit about some of the things she pointed out? Are those treated similarly in standard contracts in the industry?
Representative Lesh, the contract was not among the handouts at the back of the room. I don't have it. It was only apparently provided to the commission members. As for contracts in general, I will tell you that every attorney drafts a different contract. They're all drafted according to industry experience. And at this point, my contract is 58 pages long. The one piece of good information was, once a piece of information goes into a contract, it never comes out again. It just gets longer. So I've been doing this for 30 years. I've encountered situations, as Senator Limmer referred to, where there may be disputes, and every time there's a dispute, there's a new contractual provision that deals with that. There, I recall some of the issues that the professor raised. For example, reciting in a paragraph as a matter of concern that you recite that the intended parents will be emotionally harmed and have invested a lot of time, emotion, and energy into the process as coercive of the surrogate. I'm sorry, but these are people that have gone through 10 years of fertility efforts, gone through hope and disappointment for 10 years, have reached out because they have no other method of having a child, and a woman has stepped forward voluntarily to say, I will carry your child. To say that those intended parents would not give their embryo, their child, to that woman for care unless they were trusting her, and that they're relying on her and have their emotions invested in her, I don't think that's coercion. I think it's an accurate statement of the emotional reliance. And in the legal terms, it's called promissory estoppel or detrimental reliance. You're reciting the basis for why the intended parents are entering into that relationship. So I don't have a problem in the same way that the professor has with some of those provisions, and I find most of them to be necessary and appropriate in the contract.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Koppel, you had a question?
Thank you. I was just wondering, on previous testimony too, have you represented or do you represent both sides in a contract like that? Are there a practice standard that's followed there?
Schneider.
Commissioner Koppel, I have not. I do not represent both sides of a surrogacy agreement, which is conflicting for me. because I've been a general practitioner in the area of law for a very long time. And I scrupulously adhere to my rules of professional conduct. And my rules of professional conduct say if there are two people that have a goal that is similar and are acting in concert at the moment, and they are advised of a potential conflict, and they waive that conflict in writing, an attorney can do that. I've done it for married couples in estate planning. I've done it for two neighbors that formed a subchapter S corporation in a business. I've never done it in a surrogacy. I don't think that the rules prevent it, but I think it's a bad idea given the potential argument, especially by opponents, that surrogates are not adequately informed. So I insist that they have separate counsel, although there are many surrogates take a sister, working for a sister who can't have a child, who says, my independent counsel is going to cost $1,500 or $2,000 or $2,500, and I know my sister doesn't have the money. I don't want an attorney. I trust that my sister and I will get along. Oddly enough, I think that's where you really need an attorney, because the possibility for family coercion and birth order and I'm the boss and I always raised you because I'm your older sister comes in. But as an attorney, if she waives her right to counsel and I'm just working as an attorney with that couple, I will represent the intended parents. The sister may go without counsel because I can't force her, but I will not represent her.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Johnson.
Your presentation today kind of made me think that you would believe that agencies or a surrogate should be required to deal with an agency. Is that what I heard correct?
I don't think anybody in this process can constitutionally be required to do anything until there's a statute. So I encourage regulation and I encourage safe practices. I don't think that when intended parents find giving people in their family, their workers, co-workers, or other sources, that they should be required to go through an agency. No. I think they should be required to adhere to the same standards that an agency would impose. That's why we're inviting regulation to put safeguards in the process, such as psychological evaluation, criminal background check, independent legal representation, existence of appropriate maternity insurance, and all of the things an agency would otherwise impose, because I understand you can't and will never expect all women to work through an agency, but if they don't, they should be subject to the same rigorous screening and qualification process.
Thank you. And yes, Representative Pugh, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for the testifier is follow-up to Senator Johnson's question. Wondering if your agency, as an agency owner, wondering if your agency ever has or does make any arrangements
Mr. Schneider.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, there are agencies that will do traditional surrogacy. I have facilitated a very few of those through my agency. Let me address traditional surrogacy very briefly. Traditional surrogacy in the 1980s was the only way the medical procedures could do surrogacy. There were thousands of traditional surrogacies that were done successfully and happily without dispute among the parties. Baby M was the first one that was contested, and simultaneously with that contest, which showed the glaring disconnect between our parentage law and the use of traditional surrogacy, in vitro fertilization became medically more reliable and the procedures changed. Because of the legal uncertainty, medical professionals, attorneys, and everybody associated with the practice of surrogacy encouraged gestational carriers and discouraged traditional surrogacy. However, third-party reproduction assumes in some places that there are women that are emotionally and psychologically suited to donate their egg and do not retain any problem putting their genetics out into the stream of society for the benefit of someone else to have a child. We accept that egg donors exist and that they can be done healthily. We accept a separate proposition that women can gestate a child and deliver that child to intended parents without an emotional risk. The question is, can those two psychological profiles coexist in the same woman? I've seen it. Yes, it can. The traditional surrogacies that my agency has facilitated have not started out as traditional surrogacies. They have started out as gestational surrogacies where parents have been matched with a woman who did not intend to use her genetics. Unfortunately, the medical procedures would have been unsuccessful. The couple would have gone through numerous IVFs at the cost of $40,000 or $60,000 or $80,000, have gotten to the end of their economic capacity and not had a child. And the surrogates, on their own initiation, have said, I am bonded with you. I am in this process of your having a child, heart and soul. I am offering to be your traditional surrogate, to donate my egg as well as my uterus. If that happens, they then go through a second level of rigorous psychological evaluation to make sure that they are also suited for that process. And if that conversion is supported by psychological evidence, we allow it. In all of the cases, whether gestational or traditional, hundreds of cases through my agency, I can say the same thing Dr. Bergman said. I haven't had one case where a surrogate or intended parent has not done what they've been obligated to do. There's never been an issue with a surrogate complying with her responsibility to safely gestate the child or happily delivering the child to the intended parents at the end of the process. And the hundreds of surrogates I've worked with, none of them follow the psychological or emotional profile of being financially coerced or taken advantage of.
Any further questions? I have a question. Mr. Schneider used the term promissory estoppel. Could you define that for the benefit of those of us who didn't grab our phone and go to Google or go to law school?
Yes. I apologize for using legalese, but whenever I speak, I always say I'm an English teacher and a lawyer, so I have two languages nobody understands. So promissory estoppel is a legal concept where if two parties are discussing an arrangement and one party promises to do something for the other, and in reliance on that process, the recipient of that promise changes their position to their detriment, invests money, or starts taking action in reliance on the process, and then the person making the process doesn't keep it, even if there isn't a complete contract, promissory estoppel can provide the elements based on part performance for enforcing a contract. Is that correct, Representative Lesh?
I thought it was something different, but...
Okay. Well, we'll
thank you. Representative Lesh.
I was under the understanding that the promissory estoppel doctrine was meant to avoid a windfall on the part of one party, but they could be overlapping. I don't know.
I believe they overlap.
And
okay. I actually argued that in an appellate court case involving child custody. So,
Mr. Schneider, thank you
McNaughton
very much.
Versus McNaughton.
This is why we have judges and legislators to sort out things that lawyers can't. With regard to promissory estoppel, Mr. Schneider, it seems that you were referencing the sample contract, and there was a paragraph that Dr. Collette referred to that seemed to put some highly charged language into a contract. And if there's already promissory estoppel existing in the law, then why do we need highly charged language that a surrogate must cede to? It seems that that puts them at a disadvantage in court, saying, yes, I know these people were highly emotional and that my actions breaching this contract would fundamentally harm their vision for their future. Why should someone have to cede to that in writing in a contract if it's already something that can be argued as a fact before a court of law? Mr. Schneider.
Senator Benson, it goes to informed consent. The people complain that surrogates are not advised of their rights. On one level, it clearly notifies the surrogate that that legal precedent or concept is in the intended parent's mind, so that she's not going to overlook that. She may not be aware of the legal concept at all. Secondly, that concept has never been argued or successfully applied in a surrogacy matter, so putting it in the terms of the contract so that you've at least established perhaps the elements or the existence of those elements is a benefit until a court has litigated that. So both for the full disclosure to the surrogate that that may apply, which is to her benefit, and to the protection of the intended parents, because the legal principle has not yet been successfully applied, it's desirable in the contract.
And Mr. Schneider, I would say that anything that's written in a contract and signed then becomes a fact in a dispute, and perhaps because it's been written in, there's been no dispute. The court just assumes that everybody agrees, and that's why there was no dispute over those items. But moving on to my next question, I'm looking at services. Oh, Representative Allen, I'm sorry I jumped ahead of you. Representative Allen, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following along with your discussion here, I believe the professor raised additional concerns about, I mean, first of all, I don't think we're arguing that there wouldn't be harm. So you're establishing that if there was a material breach that there would be emotional harm. I think that what the professor may have been raising, and I don't know if she's here to respond, but the damages. So the contract, one sample contract was that they would be liable, the surrogate would be liable for damages under law and equity. There's no limitation on the damages. It doesn't seem to preclude punitive damages. And so often in contracts, one party is we protect those that don't have as much standing or trying to make sure that both parties have equal rights and remedies. And so that I think that's the concern, is that it's one-sided. And I don't know that would be enforceable, but that there just should be some sort of limitation of damages in these contracts.
Thank you. Representative Allen, did you request a response from Mr. Schneider?
If he would like to.
Okay. Mr. Schneider, please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative Allen, again, contracts vary. I wouldn't put a punitive damages clause into a contract. I don't write my contracts that way. I think punitive damages are only available under certain restricted circumstances, often statutorily based. The damages that are written into my contract, and I review contracts from all over the country, the standard contract, are simply the reimbursement to the intended parents of all the costs directly related to the process. So if the intended parents have paid for a doctor or insurance payments or legal representation or other expenses directly related to the process or part of the fee for services, and the surrogate then breaches, the remedy in my contract and most of the ones I review is limited to reimbursement or putting the parties back to where they started at the beginning of the process. And most practitioners think that's appropriate, because the typical breach is that the surrogate either attempts to keep the child, which rarely, if ever, happens in a properly regulated surrogacy, or they terminate a pregnancy without the parent's permission, which, again, I've never seen. So the kinds of breaches that would trigger that, I've never seen in any of my cases. They happen so rarely as to be hardly mentionable, but they do happen. But if that happened, what the surrogate is essentially doing is turning the surrogate pregnancy from the intended parent's pregnancy, which is under their control, into her pregnancy, which is under her control. If it's her pregnancy and she's taken control of it, if it were her pregnancy in the real world, all those expenses should be hers. So the reimbursement under the contract is the least that's fair to the intended parents, so they can start the process over elsewhere.
Thank you. Mr. Schneider, I do have a question about some of the services provided. There's a review of the surrogate's medical records. How is the privacy of the surrogate protected in that process? Because I we would assume that if the medical records become part of the contract, they're then discoverable by a court, even though she might not have been aware that by disclosing those as part of entering into a contract, she loses her right to privacy. So could you address that for us, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The review of medical records is done under specific HIPAA releases compliant with HIPAA rules, and they are directed only to participants within the process that need to see them. Specifically, obstetricians review the surrogate's pregnancy records before she's ever profiled and allowed to proceed to make sure she's had full-term vaginal deliveries without complications for two reasons. One, to protect the surrogate against an unhealthy pregnancy for her, and to protect the child and the intended parents from an unhealthy pregnancy that might adversely affect the child. So it's done in compliance with all medical privacy laws, and it's only targeted to certain individuals, and I don't believe it would be discoverable in any subsequent litigation between the parties. But
okay. Thank you. And Mr. Schneider, one more question about services provided by the agency. I don't see any guidance on best interests of the child. Could you please address the best interest of the child concerns?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Mr. Schneider.
Surrogacy is a sequence of events. A married couple, after 5 years of lack of success, decides they want to have a child. At that point, there is no child. And the parents have a constitutional right to procreate, as some constitutional legal scholars argue under Skinner and other constitutional precedent. The parents then undergo the fertility procedures to create an embryo. And depending on your disposition, a child still does not exist, but the parents' right to procreate does. There's no legal precedent anywhere in the United States that addresses the best interests of any child until after it is actually born and existing. After that point, the best interests of the child predominates in all legal precedent, including termination of parental rights if you're an unfit parent. So the agency cannot address the best interests of a being that does not yet exist. So that is not among the services in the agency contract. If the argument is we should screen all intended parents that are going through surrogacy to make sure they're not going to harm the child, if I think back of myself at 31 when I had my first daughter, I'm not sure I would have gotten permission to reproduce, but I don't think a function of screening for procreation is in place for people who procreate naturally. And the issue then becomes, is a child better off having not been born than being born and then being protected by our societal organizations and processes that protect children and families under normal circumstances? And I think Minnesota has a great system through our Department of Human Services.
So what you're saying, Mr. Schneider, is there's no discussion of the best interests of the child.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So Senator Johnson, I'll defer to you.
I just feel like I have to respond to this, because I could put myself in the place of a surrogate very easily. Because children, very important, and being pregnant was a very, very pleasant situation for me. I would not want to bring a child forward and give it to people who were not, who I would deem would not be good parents. And that's why I'm offended by this item K. If there isn't something that's also in the same vein for the surrogate to say, I want to be sure that you know that I'm giving my whole self to this event, and I don't want that child that I would put forward and give to you would be given to people who would could be not really very good parents. I don't have to say yes to you if I'm the intended parent. I say I want to give that child to someone that I know would be a good parent. So I feel it's like, stereotyping women and thinking that this would be something that would make a woman who is carrying a baby and thinking they're doing something very wonderful, and they are, that you're kind of pushing them into saying, oh, I better do a really good job because they're so important. But there's equality here. I don't know. I'm not saying it very well because I'm kind of upset about it. Mm-hmm. But I think there should be something like this item K for in any surrogate contract if we go forward with surrogacy in Minnesota.
Mr. Schneider.
Madam Chair. Yes. Senator Johnson, don't misunderstand. The question was about the best interests of the child. It wasn't about the rights or knowledge of the surrogate entering into the agreement. As Dr. Bergman indicated, criminal background checks are done into unintended parents. They're subjected to a psychological evaluation. They write a profile about their family and their support system, and all that information is shared with the surrogate before the surrogate chooses to work with them. So the surrogate has accurate and sufficient information about the nature of the relationship, the sexual orientation, the support system, their race, their geography, and their history. So she decides whether she wants to work with this particular family. That decision is made before a pregnancy ever occurs. So there's never a case a surrogate is matched with intended parents that by surprise don't take care of a child. The problem is psychological evaluation or criminal histories are not always predictive. People that have no criminal history and show no psychosis in an MMPI-2 might snap when their colicky child cries for the 16th hour and strike it and still have Child Protective Services in there, but there's no way we could have predicted that, and it's not because of a psychological defect. So it's not the best interests of the child that drives that, but as a third party in reproduction, I wholeheartedly agree with you, Senator Johnson. That surrogate has the right to be self-determinative and to have her expectations followed, too, and there are processes in the administrative services of the agency that make sure that happens.
Thank you. And if there are no further questions from the committee, I'd like to call up Crystal Lemke. Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Crystal Lemke, please correct my pronunciation.
That's right.
Thank you for joining us. And we are a little bit behind, and I apologize, but we'll give you your full opportunity to testify.
That's okay. Madam Chair, Commission members, I thank you. I was here last week, so I did get a chance to kind of go over my agency and what our role is in this process. And I'm following Dr. Bergman and Mr. Schneider, and I'm not sure I can provide anything additional to their testimonies, but I'm going to try to give you some insight to my business practices here.
Thank you.
One thing I do want to mention, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, is the emotional aspect of it, and I try to be very neutral in these proceedings and listening to them, and it's difficult for me not to have some of the emotional aspects of it come out. So one thing with surrogates I just did want to touch on is it is very much a two-way street. I might have 10 parents or two parents and tons of surrogates, and they get a say in who they want to work with. So they look at, before I even present them, I look at the characteristics of that surrogate, and I say, you know what? She wants a relationship with her parents, or she wants ongoing communication. I look at everything that surrogate wants, and I make sure that I'm matching her with somebody who shares those same values. I think that matching process is one of the most important aspects of a surrogacy journey, to start it off on the right foot and to prevent future problems. Madam Chair and Commission members, my name is Crystal Lemke, and I am the owner of My Donor Connection. We're a full-service egg donor and surrogacy agency, and I've been managing cycles since 2007. In the August 16th hearing, I did provide you guys with several documents to give you insight to my role in the screening process. I know some were long, but give you insights as to what I look for from the parents and from the gestational surrogates. It goes over the requirements that I have of surrogates as well. I hope that information helped you understand the preventative measures we take to ensure the surrogacy is properly advised and informed throughout the entire process. In the surrogacy community, there's a number of organizations that work together to self-regulate and offer the best ethical standards for all parties, from clinics, agencies, parents, egg donors, and surrogates. We encourage our partners to be participating members of these organizations as a way to hold each other accountable. We want to make sure our business ethical standards and practices are standard across the board, that we're giving the same kind of services. So just to give you guys kind of a high level what some of these organizations are, and I know that there's some handouts for these as well, is the ASRM. It's the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. They're a nonprofit organization whose members must demonstrate the high ethical principles of the medical profession, evince an interest in infertility, reproductive medicine, and biology, and adhere to the objectives of the society. There's SART. That's a Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, and they're a primary organization of professionals dedicated to the practice of assisted reproductive technologies in the U.S. And finally, there's SEEDS, and this community kind of formed up to make sure we do have consistent practices across the U.S. I know there's differences in state laws, but we want to make sure that when parents go to an agency, they are getting the same. Like Steve said, there are steps in this process that have to take place in a certain order, and they can't be omitted, and we want to make sure that all agencies are following those practices. So the Society for Ethics for Egg Donation and Surrogacy, it's a nonprofit group that was created for U.S. agencies to work together to define a set of ethical standards for egg donation and surrogacy programs. We have regularly held meetings and conferences to discuss the ethical standards of our profession, from advertising to storage information. We're constantly evaluating and redefining the responsibilities we are entrusted with as agency professionals. So in the absence of legislation, we turn to guidance to items from like the Model Act. When items like this come up, we look at these and say, what are we missing? What can we add to this? We want to prevent issues from coming up in the future. As an agency owner, it's my responsibility to hold myself accountable to these standards. Without regulation, we cannot force other agencies to adhere to these suggested ethical practices. But with that regulation, hopefully we can protect all parties involved. With that, I open myself to questions.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Ms. Lemke?
Because it's 3 o'clock.
Legislators get less inquisitive as it comes to the end of the committee. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Lemke, I know you went over this at the last meeting about some of the criteria that you require for surrogates and intended parents. But I want to build on that question I had last time off of what you had said. What of those regulations would you think that we should have in state statute? Maybe that's a sufficient question.
Ms. Lemke.
Madam Chair, Senator Wills, Representative Wills, I'm not sure I can just pick out specific ones in here. I think all the ones that I include in my process are ones that I think should be included. I'm not sure if you have a copy of what I provided last time, but I'm happy to go over it or to bring another copy to go over those requirements. I'm not sure. I do have it in front of me, so I can go over, or I can give you a copy that I have.
Mr. Lutwick, did you have? Well, I wasn't to that point. I just was going to say I had a question.
Okay. Representative Wills.
I have the copy of the criteria at home, so that's not my question, I guess, but that helped me understand. So you feel that the criteria that you have would be what you would want other agencies to abide by, and you feel you have met a threshold that addresses all potential concerns, and that's why you would like to see that criteria as state law?
Thank you, Representative Wells. Yes, I do. I do think that that's a minimum requirement. And what I base my information off of is items like the Model Act for agencies. So it is pretty consistent across the U.S. with agencies. You will find some that that might vary a little bit, but working together with attorneys and clinics, we all have very similar standards.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Flesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lemke, Representative Will's questions made me think of, I guess, another question that I had and probably should have asked of the other testifiers also, but whenever this body is looking at, or these bodies, I guess, is looking at proposed legislation on anything from financial services to health care to whatever, especially in a new area of law or licensing, we will have typically the best actors come forward, the people who are responsible operators, with one exception. I remember when we were looking at the payday lending legislation, there was that same guy that kept coming around that was the subject of all these lawsuits, and I couldn't figure out why they put him forward as their spokesperson. But that was the only time I can think of. This guy is a real piece of work, too. But normally in these cases, we've got the good actor. So I'm assuming that you're a good actor. And you operate, your contract is good, you treat people well, you operate ethically. But you probably are also aware of maybe some other actors in the industry that don't operate that way. And so I'm going to ask Representative Will's question in the inverse. What pitfalls should we be expressly aware of? So if and when folks start coming around and saying, well, no, you need to give us some latitude on this, should we be wary of what issues, if any?
That's a big question.
Representative Lesch, there are practices that I hear about and we hear about in the media sometimes that scare us or give surrogacy kind of a bad light. Those are few and far in between, but with regulation, if we were going to move forward, things that I would be wary of agencies are ones that don't follow these steps. And like I said, there's a lot of steps that are involved here. So agencies that might manage their clients' escrow, that's a red flag right there. You want to make sure that their money is being held in an outside licensed, bonded, insured escrow account. That protects the parents, the money that they've put on file for the investment they've put for the surrogate fees, the attorney fees, the medical process. So that's a big one, making sure that there's legal representation, making sure that there's separate legal representation, and that's something I'm very firm on. We don't want instances where they're going to court and they have one attorney. That's just not how we practice. I always make sure that they do have a separate representation, and up until, well, I've never encountered a situation where the parents didn't understand the importance of that and strive to waive the surrogate's fee. So we want to make sure that she is protected just as much as the intended parents. Insurance review. So there's all these things that we would like to include in there. It's a long list, so I'm not sure if you want to go through all of this now or if you want me to put something together to include maybe things that we would like to see included. But
well sure.
Thank you. Did that answer your question?
It did. Yeah, it's a start. Ms. Lemke, thank you. And yes, I'd like to, maybe if you had that list and you had time to think about it, mm-hmm. I'd like to maybe get that offline from you.
Okay.
So that I'm more aware of where the red flag should be.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and by the way, it was the equity stripping guy, not the payday lending. When the subprime market crashed and everyone was getting the equity stripped, it was that guy. I don't remember his name. Pollock remembers.
I'm just glad you weren't like me.
Right away. With that, bringing it back of. Is there anyone else with further questions for this testifier? Okay, and before we go, Representative Pugh, you had some closing questions or things you would like addressed? Representative Pugh, you have time to get off mute.
Okay. There she is.
Madam Chair, I can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yes, okay. Yes, I'm very sorry. And thank you. I am going to be at a very difficult time hearing the first two testifiers, and my question would be for them. However, I am going to go back and listen to the hearing, and if I have any comments, I will make a note of that for the record. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Are there any other questions before us today? Mr. Pollack.
Senator Benson, we adopted the draft work plan by way of the minutes, and there are a couple errors in the draft work plan that it might be worth revising for the next meeting. Meeting 9 lists the meeting time as 10 p.m. Meeting 10 lists the meeting as taking place, I think it's meant to be 2018, but it should be 2016. I would also, and then that's technical, more substantively, and we don't have to decide this today, but maybe just for consideration, I would propose that we determine a majority-minority report by the meeting number 8, because I think it would be helpful to have that context for meeting number 9, and I would also propose that meeting number 10, the statement be review draft report, because if we're reviewing the final report, then it's the final report.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Pollack, and so I'm going to request that staff make amendments as Mr. Pollack recommended, and the committee be given that as a separate document, be given the draft work plan as a separate document from meeting minutes so that we can review it on its own standing and amend as needed. And with that, seeing no further business before this commission, we are adjourned.